tena koutou katoa. Thank you to the organisers for this opportunity to contribute to Te Pai Roa, and I'd also like to say mahalo to Kiawe for his analysis and wisdom and the clarity by which you shared with us the advancement of the Kanaka Māori people. I'm here today because I got an ever so gentle tap from Professor Sumehana Juri, and a similar gentle tap from my whanaunga te kani kingi to come along and talk. I had the honour of sharing a particular journey in Māori self-determination with Sumehana and Sutamati and Sutumu and others during the years of the National Māori Congress. And what a journey that was. It shaped the views that I continue to hold today about what iwi Māori self-determination looks and feels like. It also honed my appreciation of what a meaningful mandate is and what responsibilities come from representing iwi Māori in the international arena. I served with the late Sir Robert Mahuta as co-chair of the Māori Congress Foreign Policy Committee, which, amongst other things, developed an articulation of what we termed the international personality of the treaty nation Aotearoa New Zealand. And based on that articulation, we began the process of developing treaty and tikanga Māori-based foreign policy. I'd also like to acknowledge Dr. Selwyn Kātani and Manuka Henare, who were also members of the committee and who contributed to this work. So you might ask, what is tikanga Māori-based foreign policy? Well, to begin with, it determines who we see as allies and like-minded and who we do not. It provides a deeper insight into the causes of many regional conflicts in other parts of the world and whose side we as Indigenous peoples might favour. It also shapes positions that we might take in the global sustainable development agenda or in Indigenous norms and standards, trade, globalisation, and on many other issues. And it underpins how we operationalise diplomacy across sovereign nations. Speakers before me have referred to those who attended the 1984 Hui Taumata as either dead or dying. I just wanted to say I was there, and I don't fit either category as far as I know. I had in fact recently returned to Aotearoa after living in Canada for 12 years, and the first job I found in New Zealand was with the then TVNZ as a journalist and documentaries researcher. And I was part of the TVNZ crew that covered Hui Taumata. I was totally out of my league in terms of understanding Māori iwi politics. So for me, the Hui Taumata really represented the beginning of a learning curve, as it signalled to me that Māori are a lot more complex than I had realised, and that diplomacy and relationships are part of the fabric of Māori as a people and what holds us together. In 1992, I did speak at the Hui Whakapūmau, and my talk at that time was entitled Māori Leadership, the Waka Tradition, the Crews Were the Real Heroes. At that time, I was concerned about the direction Māori might take in the post-treaty settlement environment without a clear vision of the type of society and well-being we wanted. And I hoped that that would be an inclusive society, respectful of all generations and genders. I was also worried about Western notions of who matters in society, who are deemed heroes. Perhaps uncharitably, I said that anyone can claim to be a captain, but without a willing, skilled crew, the waka will go nowhere. To me, the warning signals were already beginning to manifest at that time in terms of the model of development that iwi Māori were being encouraged to adopt. I didn't speak at the 2005 Hui Taumata convened in Wellington, but I have been pretty consistent in the issues that I have steadily followed: Indigenous rights, sustainable development, intellectual property rights, because all of these issues bring to the fore the integrity of culture and what it means to be Indigenous. And over the years, I've maintained a fairly cautious approach to Māori leadership and iwi Māori visions. And my talk at the 2012 Ngā Pai o Te Maramatanga conference, which I called Guardians and Gold Diggers, sort of attests to that. You know, I wouldn't have predicted this 10 years ago, but I actually agreed with much of what Sutipine O'Regan said yesterday. We used to be poles apart in our views, but I agreed with him in particular when he said that our problem is we don't have a clear articulation of what we want New Zealand to be in the future and our role and contribution to that. But I would add to this two other dimensions, Māori as global citizens and kotahitanga. We need to not only have a clear articulation of what we want New Zealand to be like in the future, but also what we want the world to be like and our role and contribution in making that happen. Māori are operating at many levels throughout the globe, as many other speakers have said, in the arts, sports, commerce, leading international initiatives, networks and processes. We are truly global citizens. One of the many issues that the National Māori Congress tried to address during its time was kotahitanga as an overarching korowai where all iwi, irrespective of population, territorial size or wealth, were considered equal, and where a conscious effort was made to develop as a people, not just as an iwi. And to some extent, the treaty settlement has eroded that vision. The treaty settlement process has eroded that vision because we're moving in a sort of direction of iwi by iwi, case by case basis. So we have some iwi in a strong situation, others less so, and others in a perilously weak situation. And we are seeing the emergence of super iwi and an ever-increasing number of these post-treaty settlement agreements between iwi and Crown agencies. John Tamihere, who I never used to agree with either, but he reminded us yesterday that in many cases there are more members of the iwi outside of Arohe than inside. And yet the governance structures, including the new structures that are being established post-treaty settlements, operate as if that wasn't a consideration. I struggle with the terms with developing or development as descriptors of the pathway that Māori are following. Develop to what? The problem with development as a framework is that when do you know you've got there? You know, when do you know you've reached the threshold of what you set out to achieve? That is, you're now developed. And according to whose definition? Whole countries can be underdeveloped. And we even have least developed countries. In fact, as we speak now, in Apia, Samoa, they're hosting the UN SIDS meeting, Small Island Developing Countries, the majority of which are in the least developing status. They are the ones who are feeling the brunt of climate change already. They're arranging relocations of their peoples into other countries as their islands are starting to disappear under the sea through rising sea levels. So there's a lot of activity at the global level around developing and least developed countries. But that begs the question, can a country or can a people be overdeveloped? So development, my fundamental concern with it, is that it has been co-opted into the capitalist perpetual growth model. Hekia made reference earlier this morning to an education system developed in the 19th century, being taught by teachers of the 20th century for youth in the 21st century. And she argued the system needed an overhaul. Well, consider, therefore, that the main economic system that we continue to follow, was developed in the 14th century. It is long past its use-by date, and it has now moved into a very perverse capitalism that breeds disparity within peoples and across countries. And it is a model that sends shivers up my spine when I hear iwi leaders using it. We need a completely different paradigm. I think it's the OECD that sets the global indicators of what constitutes well-being, what constitutes poverty. But these indicators are not neutral. They favour a Western worldview of what matters and who matters. And this is why many developing countries are creating new indicators, such as Bhutan's national happiness indicators, and alternate models to perpetual growth that look more at quality of life for all. For me, a better descriptor of what we are trying to achieve here is Māori resilience, or Māori self-determination, or Māori advancement. But I don't like the development word. I know it's completely tied into so much vocabulary around Māori policy, but we need to move beyond it. So while 2014 marks 30 years since the inaugural Hui Taumata, it also marks roughly the same number of years for the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The Hui Taumata was held in 1984, and the first year of the drafting of the Declaration began in 1985. Māori first attended the UN Working Group 3 years into that drafting process in 1988, and hence we've always behaved as taina in the Indigenous rights movement, because we weren't the ones who led it. We came in after. And sometimes some of our delegates who are going overseas now forget that. I initially participated as a delegate of Te Runanga o Ngāti Pro and Te Runanga o Ngāti Awa, and once the Māori Congress was established, I, together with many others, participated in the drafting of that declaration wearing a Māori Congress hat as well. We can look at that declaration and see very specific issues that Māori contributed. In the case of Article 2, that came about through Ngāti Te Ata raising the issues of the Maioro tar sands, and in particular access in privacy to sacred places. Article 31, we can look to Ngāti Awa and the whole story of the repatriation of the mātā to a wharenui and cultural and intellectual property rights. And Article 16, Māori also contributed to that, that's rights to Indigenous-owned media in native language, in native languages, and that was because at that time we were going through a claim here in New Zealand around state-owned enterprises and around broadcasting. Text on the right to self-determination didn't appear in the declaration until 1991, and our very own Moana Jackson was very instrumental in helping that language be introduced. And it was only in the very final session of the 93 meeting of the Working Group on Indigenous Populations that there was general consensus for the right to self-determination. And I could point to many other instances where you can show the direct contribution iwi and Māori Congress made to a range of international processes. So the first commemorative Hui Taumata was 1992, and 1 year later, in 1993, is when the declaration moved from the lower echelon of the UN up through the quagmire of the UN system, taking 10 years before it got to the UN General Assembly for a vote in 2007. And we'll never forget that vote, because as all the names of the countries flashed up on the screen voting yes, Only four lonely countries were on the other side of the screen voting no. New Zealand, Australia, Canada, US, Kansas. But in 2010, government changed that position to one of support for the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and we really have the Honourable Peter Sharples and his team to thank for that change. Without a political champion willing to do what needed to be done inside government, that wouldn't have happened. So where are we now? Hui Taumata 30 years on and the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples 7 years as an official UN standard. We have the Crown and iwi responsible for implementing treaty settlements. We also have government and iwi responsible for implementing the declaration. It's a declaration of 46 articles that Suedi Jury refers to as filling out how the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi can be applied. The declaration provides minimum standards for the survival, dignity and well-being of Indigenous peoples globally. But let's be clear, the Crown does not want to implement this. And it is up to us to force their implementation in the same way it was up to us to force implementation of the Treaty of Waitangi. The declaration speaks clearly of the unique role of Indigenous peoples as guardians, kaitiaki of their lands, seas and waters, a role that no other peoples have. It places Indigenous communities as more than ethnic minorities or stakeholders, but as kaitiaki tasked with protecting the heritage of future generations. And to my mind, this is a mantra that needs to be continually reinforced. I think back to the Rugby World Cup opening when John Key omitted to incorporate Ini Te Reo Māori into his speech, even when the chairman of the International Rugby Union had done so. Key said he only had 1.5 minutes to speak. And he said, I could have, of course, and for the most part I generally do, but I decided not to on that occasion. The thing is, this is a cautionary tale for Māori, because what I see happening a lot is that in the 1.5 minute bite-sized statements that some Māori leaders are making, without acknowledgement and continued reinforcement of the primary role of a kaitiaki, what the public hears is iwi Māori wanting a piece of the economic action of natural resources, oil, gas and water. And if we don't reinforce the role of kaitiaki, after time it drops from our vocabulary and it drops from our consciousness. Keawe reminded us that the world wants and needs our knowledge of the environment and our values. And this is true. The thing is, they don't. There's no evidence that they want us, that they want us as distinct peoples. And it's a major challenge that sits ahead for Indigenous peoples, including Māori. The declaration also speaks of the need to promote Indigenous languages and knowledge systems and to establish our own education and broadcasting initiatives to maintain and grow culture, not as capital, but as heritage. And I'm just going to put this out there, but if we really want te reo to flourish in the future, we need to prioritise good speakers of te reo on our marae over gender. If it's really about the language, prove it. Others have spoken on the changed world we now live in, a world where Māori are as active in as they are at home, a world where conflict over resources is on the rise, where defending the environment is increasingly being seen as an act of terrorism, needing legal intervention, where corporations, corruption and government are becoming so interwoven as to be indistinguishable, and where our natural resources are being compromised and in some cases depleted through overconsumption and greed. So iwi in the post-settlement environment have a much more complex world to deal with in 2014 than they did in 1984. And our visions of Māori resilience and self-determination therefore cannot just be about here. They must, by necessity, include the globe and the planet. And I was looking at the phrases by Māori for Māori, and I just coined some new ones. So, by Māori for a better world, by Māori for future generations, and by Māori for a healthy planet. Nō reira, tēnā koutou. Tēnā koutou.